You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast, sponsored by The Nation magazine. This week, I want to take up the issue of Joe Biden's foreign policy, which is the subject of a book review written by a friend of the show, David Kleon, in The Nation. And he's reviewing a recent book, The Internationalist, The Fight to Restore American Foreign Policy After Trump by Alexander Ward. So David has some issues with the book, which I think we'll start discussing with. But then I want to talk more broadly about, you know, what is actually Joe Biden's foreign policy, and maybe what are some of the ways in which it's become the kind of Achilles heels of his presidency, something that it really endangers his reelection chances. And beyond that, I think actually, you know, really threatens to split the Democratic coalition apart. So, David, welcome to the program.
Always great to be here.
So let's just talk about the book that you reviewed. I mean, you are fairly critical of the book, but I think your criticisms also are aligned with the subject, like that the author is very close to the makers of Biden's foreign policy. And so I think the two maybe go hand in hand. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I want to start by giving the author, Alex Ward, his due. First of all, he's been a class act about this. You know, I've just started work on a book myself, my first, and it'll be a while, but, you know, I hope to take criticism as well as he's taking it. You know, he's been really just cool about it and interested to talk. And I also want to say, and I hope this came through in the review itself, you know, I didn't go into this with any beef with him, nor do I have any real criticism of him as a reporter. I think he's an excellent reporter. And the day job he has that this book came out of, which is, you know, breaking stories about what the Biden team is doing, is an important job, and he does it well. And I have no beef with that at all. And I don't know that I have any real ideological beef with him either. I mean, as far as I know, he's in the, you know, probably rough political ballpark as me or a lot of people I know, give or take. It's not really his job to be political. You know, it's his job to break news, and doing that on the beat he has requires developing relationships with people like Jake Sullivan, the president's national security advisor, or Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, or other people in that world. And that's just kind of the nature of the job. Other people, you know, report other things. The problem with the book I have is kind of how it comes together as a book. I don't totally dismiss it. I mean, it's certainly an interesting book full of detailed reporting. If you care about how the foreign policy sausage gets made or understanding the Biden team better, it's certainly worth reading.
And I should add, just based on your review and but also my reading of other things by Ward, like he actually does is very good at conveying the thinking of the Biden administration. Yeah. Like if you want to understand how the people in the Biden's inner circle see the world, how they think of what they're doing, I think, you know, like the book seems excellent on that grounds, and I think that's actually a very useful exercise. You want to know, like, what is the thinking behind Biden's foreign policy?
Right. All of which is to say, first of all, this wasn't a pan. Second of all, I didn't go in intending to do a hit job. I went in. I was assigned the book, and I went in with a very open mind. And I did get a lot out of it. And I do, you know, I'm an Alex Ward fan. My problems are conceptual, and I imagine have as much to do with publishing as anything else. I mean, the concept of this book is let's tell the story of the first 2 years of Biden's foreign policy. Now, I think this is a genre in nonfiction publishing. Let's get someone on, you know, the economy beat or whatever to tell the story of the first two years or the first 100 days or whatever it is of a given presidency, an arbitrary stretch of time. And it's basically reporting strung together, and you have to impose a kind of narrative. And it's an inherently frustrating genre, I think, because, you know, the end of a presidential term seems like the logical place for those narratives to go. Or you tell a story that has its own narrative arc that may not be bound in a one presidential term or whatever. But to just have it be the first 2 years, there's nothing inherently important about that. And in order to make a satisfying book, you have to come up with an arc that makes sense. And so the arc that the book has, which Ward is quite explicit about in the acknowledgments, is a kind of classic dramatic arc that, you know, makes sense as pure storytelling, which is these guys, the Biden foreign policy team, the A team, as they're called, they come in with the sort of lofty intentions to you know, bring America back after Donald Trump embarrassed it. You know, they're smart, competent, idealistic people. And one of the things they want to do is pull out of Afghanistan. And they do pull out of Afghanistan, and it obviously goes disastrously. And they all feel really bad about that. But then the war in Ukraine starts, and they rally the world to Ukraine's defense. And they feel good about that. And they get their mojo back, as Ward says. So it's a heroic arc. And that's the basic structure of the book. There's obviously details and nuances, including a chapter somewhere in the middle, one chapter dealing with the Middle East, which kind of had to be there, but, you know, is less of a focus than it might have been, which I think is also how the administration or parts of it felt about the Middle East. The problem with doing this, of course, is that in the time it takes for, you know, the book to finish editing and get published, the world completely changes. And as I say in the review, that's not Ward's fault at all. Certainly not that October 7th happened. That's not his fault. Nor do I get the sense that Ward would be supportive of the administration's policy on October 7th. I believe he's covered it critically, as anyone should. But the problem is the story that the book is trying to tell, this kind of like redemption arc about these guys we're basically supposed to root for, even if we can criticize them, you know, collides headlong into what's happening now when they're all accomplices to what I'm comfortable calling a genocide or certainly an ethnic cleansing, a collective punishment of a civilian population, a mass atrocity. Take your pick, but it's monstrous. And everyone in this book is at least partially complicit in it, although I think the ultimate villain on the American side here is Biden himself. So, you know, again, could Ward have predicted the future? No. But I think that in reading the book, I can only read it now with an eye to, you know, who are these guys that they would end up letting this be a part of their legacy. Now, if you read between the lines of reporting now, you know, there's been a much mocked genre of article over the last 6 months or so that's basically, you know, Biden feels really frustrated with what Netanyahu is doing in Gaza. And, you know, he's so frustrated he might actually do anything at all to stop it, but someday, but not yet. And we keep reading those. And one cynical and possibly accurate way to read those is this is just the bare minimum that Biden feels like putting out there to appease his critics on the left. And maybe that's all there is to it. But a nuance that I think you can sometimes detect in these articles is I think much of the Biden administration, including fairly senior people, actually understands that the policy has gone too far. That's not to say that if it were up to Jake Sullivan or Tony Blinken, the U.S. policy would be from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free. But I do think many people, including probably those two, if they got to set policy by themselves, would have tried to rein in Netanyahu harder, faster, and understand exactly how bad this all looks, that the U.S. is, you know, basically party to engineering a famine now. They've dropped hints, I think, that they genuinely get that. And from the backgrounds they have and the people they talk to, I mean, just for instance, Ben Rhodes is out of government, but he and, he had something close to Jake Sullivan's role in the Obama administration. And they founded this group, National Security Action, that laid out a lot of Biden's foreign policy during the transition period. And I suspect they talk still. That's just my guess that Rhodes and Sullivan are close. And Rhodes, who's outside and working for Crooked Media in L.A., has been actually a pretty staunch critic of Biden's Israel policies.
As have the sort of Obama circle in general.
Yeah, as have all his colleagues, Jon Favreau and Tommy Vitor. It's very clear what they think. And my guess is Jake Sullivan knows they're right. But Jake Sullivan is working in the administration and is ultimately answerable to Joe Biden. And the subtext of much of the reporting I get is that Joe Biden specifically is really, really stubborn about being pro-Israel and has and I'm working on something about this now, actually, but has a really just deep, or Jonathan Geyer just had a cover story in the American Prospect to this effect. And And Ward actually goes into it in his Middle East chapter. Joe Biden really loves Israel and really loves being a Zionist, like more than the median Democrat, more than Obama or the Clintons or John Kerry. It's really something. And
And I also mentioned there was actually a really excellent piece in Mother Jones about this, which I'll link to as well. Joe Biden is like, perhaps the most Zionist president the United States has ever had. And he calls himself openly a Zionist. And that article was by Noel Lenard, by the way.
The question here is basically, if we can all, progressive critics, broadly agree the Israel policy is a moral and strategic and political disaster, and we can also agree that Biden himself has at the very least compounded how big a disaster it is and passed opportunities to mitigate it in any way, and we can suspect that the A team described in this book understand that on some level and have sort of been working behind the scenes as best they can to rein in the damage, but ultimately Biden is the decider. If that's all true, then the question becomes, why have none of them resigned yet, basically?
I mean, exactly, because the situation you're describing, I mean, that was exactly the situation in the Vietnam War, in the sense that, the top people, including Robert McNamara, knew fairly early on, like I'm talking about like 1965 or 66, that the war was a disaster and that what the administration was saying to the American people about the light at the end of the tunnel and how the war was going was lies. If you're in that, but the president was stubbornly committed to this policy, like as a matter of not just a policy, but a sort of personal psychological commitment.
Well, he didn't want to be the president to lose a major war. That's right.
So if that's the case, then yeah, what you do is like you do resign. One can criticize someone like McNamara for not being more outspoken once he was out of government. But I mean, there were people at that point who did actually jump ship. And it is notable currently that has, with a few honorable exceptions, there haven't been many resignations in this administration.
Well, there's I for my own book research on the neocons, I just read Gitlin's book on the 60s, Todd Gitlin's book on the 60s, which is called The 60s and is a very interesting book, if occasionally maddening, but a terrific read. And he does recreate this scene where essentially all the like most important, kind of like wealthy establishment cabal on the Democratic side, the real movers and shakers in Georgetown and places like that, get together in a room with Lyndon Johnson in 1968 and say, look, you all our kids are mad at us. All the campuses we care about are in flames. You've lost, not necessarily the whole public so much as the part of the public we care about, like rich kids. And, this isn't working and we can't support what you're doing. And that's why Johnson doesn't run for re-election. Like the protests really did work because they convinced the Eastern establishment that, Nixon would go on to demonize. They convinced them that this was a lost cause, and they went to Johnson and told him that. And I keep wondering, we're getting the protests. They've clearly lost the younger generation on this issue. When do the Tony Blinkens of the world all get together with Biden and tell him, sir, you've failed and you have to change course here. we've lost confidence in you, basically.
I mean, that is an actually interesting question. I mean, just in terms of public opinion, like the American public is far more opposed to what's happening in Gaza than the American public was to the Vietnam War in 1968. Like even after the Tet Offensive, you did have like majority support for the Vietnam War, which you have not had.
And there are various reasons. I mean, one is, decades of cultural change. One is that, in the Vietnam War, the, Vietnamese peasants weren't like uploading photos of what was happening to them to the internet where anyone could see them. I mean, we've never really seen an atrocity like this from the inside to the extent that we are right now, and it's chilling.
We've covered the book and some of the issues or problems with the book, which, as you suggest, are structural in terms of the genre it's in. But I think this point about the Vietnam War like maybe gets at like the larger issue of Biden's foreign policy, and like thinking about in your review, you give quite a bit of space to Jake Sullivan, who is a major figure in the book as well. It seems to me like Jake Sullivan is, presents the sort of, as Ben Rhodes did under Obama, the sort of ideological rationale for Biden's foreign policy, the ideological thinking that goes into it. And it's a not totally unappealing theory. And it's, I think, worth talking about because it's partially an appeal to some segments of the left. That what Sullivan is kind of presenting is, and what Biden, I think, also believes in, is a kind of refurbished Cold War liberalism. The liberalism of a Humphrey or a Scoop Jackson, who Biden like was very close to. And this is a liberalism of like, we're going to, America's going to be the dominant superpower. We're going to be very much in the world, the hegemon, but we're going to look after our own people. We need a strong domestic base at home. We need good union jobs. We need manufacturing. We need infrastructure. And we're going to use all the military spending will feed into, domestic repair so that you get middle class buy-in for this project of American global hegemony. I think, it's a for the left, like, it can be a more, it is basically the sort of, you know, military Keynesianism that gave the great economy of the 50s and early 60s that, you know, has such a nostalgic hold on the American imagination. And it's not totally unappealing, like, in the sense of, well, you know, like, you'll at least have a government that, like, you know, wants to, that is not neoliberal, that actually wants to, like, take care of people on the home front. So do you think that's a fair assessment of, like, where Biden and Sullivan are, like, in terms of their conception of their foreign policy?
Yes, to an extent. I think certainly in terms of the sort of domestic underpinnings of it, yes. So as alluded to earlier, Jake Sullivan and Ben Rhodes were the architects of this thing called National Security Action. Which was one of these kind of shadow government transition projects you get when you're in opposition. You know, Jake Sullivan, actually, I want to digress for a moment and do a little, but this is related to what you're asking, a little armchair sociology, psychosociology of Jake Sullivan and Ben Rhodes as counterpoints, because these are, you know, two white guys about the same age. They're in their 40s now. Who Rhodes was never national security advisor, but he was basically Obama's, you know, speechwriter and right-hand man on foreign policy. And they had a mind meld, as they said. And then Sullivan is national security advisor to Biden. And had Hillary Clinton won in 2016, he would have been her national security advisor in all likelihood. So, and these guys are peers and friends, last I checked. But they're different in a way that's kind of interesting. They're temperamentally different, which I suspect is a difference in where exactly they're coming from. Because Ben Rhodes, I think went to like an Upper East Side private school. He's a kind of like dilettantish Manhattan elite. And I say that with affection. I know such people. You know, smoked pot, wanted to be a novelist in the mold of Don DeLillo. That's the persona he's always kind of marketed himself with, and sort of like fluked his way into shaping global events. And because of that, he's always had a pose I understand very well, that of the kind of someone who's insider enough by background that he can kind of like present himself as a detached outsider who sees these people up close, sees they're full of shit, and is willing to be skeptical and critical because he knows he's, you know, he fundamentally is able to do so. In some ways, this is a pose I have a similar enough background that in some ways this is a pose I affect myself. Now, Sullivan is coming from somewhere different, and America rewards both of these types, I think. Sullivan is the son of, you know, of I think a public school teacher or something of that nature in Minneapolis, you know, one of the last places that works in America. He went to public schools. He was like star of his class, straight A student, you know, debate team, quiz bowl, all that. Yale Law, Rhodes Scholar, like Supreme Court clerkship, you know, worked for Amy Klobuchar, was going to be Hillary Clinton's national security advisor at 40, which is also in my review, I cast them both as as fellow Wunderkinds. But these are actually very important differences, I think. And I'm not, you know, I know people who would relate more to one of those archetypes versus one of the other, basically the kind of like middle class achiever versus the, comfortably ensconced stoner, you know, critic. But you can kind of see it in how they, in the roles they played in their respective administrations, right? I mean, Rhodes was always pissing off the foreign policy establishment precisely because he would break with it and he would criticize it. I mean, he's the one who gave us the term the blob. Mm-hmm. This notion that all of Washington foreign policy is this kind of like groupthink that, you know, always goes toward military intervention, which is an idea that has now, you know, outlasted the Obama presidency by a lot. That comes from him. And to his credit, I guess, he never really joined the blob. He moved to LA after he left office and he didn't go back into government, so he could stay in this critic mode. Whereas Sullivan, you can tell, has been gunning to be part of the blob his entire life. And he is a consummate blob guy now. Not to say, you know, it's not like the blob is truly monolithic or agrees on everything. The Afghan withdrawal, which Biden really did, it was not popular in the blob. It very much went against the grain. It's probably the place where they've most gone out on a limb in the Biden administration, certainly on foreign policy. And, but, you know, Rhodes was the one saying, let's not strike Syria, when most of Obama's other advisors and most of official Washington were. Rhodes was instrumental in opening Cuba, you know, on the Iran deal and selling that to a skeptical Washington, skeptical Democratic Party. So you could see, and Obama, although they ended up giving Israel a huge amount of aid, you know, it was always clear that Obama and Rhodes hated Netanyahu and thought his settlement policy was wrong, to the point where in their lame duck period, they didn't even veto a UN resolution condemning it. It was a symbolic gesture, but they were making very clear. And it's why the neocons and Israel hawks hated Obama and hated Ben Rhodes. And, you know, the Biden administration, Biden is such an utterly conventional thinker on most of these things, except that he really wanted out of Afghanistan. And Sullivan, and then Blinken, who's this kind of aristocratic type, who's clearly been training his whole life to be, you know, a consummate blob figure, like even more than Sullivan. You know, these guys are just different kind of social types with different temperaments. They're fully bought into that kind of proud mid-century American idea that you have. And Biden, in a more in a less prestige hungry way, is too, more maybe the blue collar envisioning of the same thing. Right. The period you're talking about is a period where all American boats were rising. Right. And someone would butt in and say, not black people, but no, their boat was rising too. It was the high point of the civil rights movement in many ways. So, you know, you're talking about a period when corporate America was doing well, intellectual America was doing well, middle-class America was doing well, blue-collar America was doing well, black America was certainly advancing. You know, when there was this, you know, this kind of like holistic consensus about America doing well. I mean, the places that weren't doing well were the rest of the world. You know, largely because it had consumed itself in fire in World War II, or was going through, you know, colonial wars or decolonizing wars or whatever. But, you know, America was like half of global GDP at the end of World War II. And we had a 20-year period when to be an American was a pretty great thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Sullivan is way too young. Really, Blinken is almost too young to have really internalized that period the way Biden did. But I think you're right that they all harken back to it in some ways.
That was a kind of, you know, the golden age of the American century. And it's natural that even though people who haven't lived from it see that as, you know, like, that's the way things should be. That's the ideal order.
Right. When it comes to the domestic policy prescriptions, I think you and I agree. I think most observers agree that, you know, maybe it hasn't been everything we ever could have wanted under Bernie Sanders or whatever. But I think, you know, the consensus is, yeah, Biden did, in fact, reverse a sort of four-decade neoliberal trend. I talk about this in my recent book forum piece about Joshua Green's book, The Rebels. You know, that period is over. The period of Clintonomics and Obamanomics is over. You know, the period of worrying about deficits and caring what Larry Summers thinks is over, basically. And Jake Sullivan was bought in on that. I mean, he had expected to be in a Hillary Clinton administration that probably would have continued on that course in 2016. Obviously, Trump won and upset everything. And he and Rhodes spent the Trump years sort of mapping out what should the next Democratic foreign policy be instead? And they really wanted to prioritize the interests of the American middle class.
I mean, to me, that's the sort of morally interesting and complicated element of the story, which is, you know, there's this attractive element of, you know, like, let's have, you know, like a foreign policy vision that serves the American people. And it's not just about, you know, making the corporations rich. And in some ways, I mean, if it is, you know, like, you know, making allowances for all the differences that have changed in the world, some attempt at a restoration of, you know, Cold War liberalism and military Keynesianism, it then recreates some of the same dilemmas and contradictions of that earlier form. And, you know, like for the left, Lyndon Johnson was a real problem because on the one hand, this is a guy who domestically is giving you like everything you could possibly want, right? Like, you know, like both civil rights, you know, huge expansion of the welfare state, but is, you know, like pursuing, you know, like really brutal imperialist foreign policy that is both bad in itself and threatening to the world. And this created a dilemma. You know, this is Martin Luther King Jr.'s dilemma in the last 2 years of his life. And, you know, like, how do you grapple with a president that's both, you know, giving you everything you want, but is doing something that's morally beyond the pale?
And it should be said, and in this way, it doesn't parallel the war in Gaza in the same way. It was very bad for America domestically, too.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it was, you know, drafting mostly working class men and sending them off to die in this terrible, pointless war. And it was, you know, which was also sort of demonstrating all sorts of class and race fissures at home and exacerbating social tensions that threatened to consume the Great Society reforms. And it was blowing a huge amount of money that should have been spent on the Great Society on this.
I mean, it's obviously a much greater in terms of scale. Although on that last point, like you know, if like Israel does, you know, drag America into a bigger like Middle Eastern war, right, you know, which is a real possibility, like with what's happening with Iran, then you know, like you will actually see like you have actually seen Americans die for Gaza. You've had seen. But you'll see many more Americans die for Gaza.
To the administration's limited credit, it seems clear to me that Joe Biden does not want that.
He doesn't want that.
Any number of Palestinians dying and with the, you know, Israel's destruction of Gaza, but he does not want a regional war. He does not want a U.S. war with Iran. That seems very obvious.
But that is the danger, right?
And the right-wing Israel hawks are all furious at him for how he basically didn't take the bait last week.
Absolutely. We have to make allowances for, you know, the real differences. But I actually think that the, you know, fundamental dilemma or contradiction, I mean, the, you know, dilemma people had in 68, how do you support, how do you deal with a Democratic Party that's giving you what you want, but is like, you know, very bad on foreign policy? That is the dilemma of 2024. And I would say more broadly, the, you know, it's both a dilemma for the voters, but it's also a contradiction within the system. That is to say that the idea that you can, you know, build up the domestic economy through military Keynesianism and through, you know, a very aggressive American hegemony, you know, like it runs into like contradictions that unravel itself. And we saw that in Vietnam. And I think we might be seeing that now with Joe Biden.
I think there's a lot to be said for that. I think that in the piece I talk about essentially how the things they wanted to do going in, the things that Jake Sullivan wanted were, he wanted to prioritize domestic issues, which is, you know, only partly in some ways it seems like it falls outside the purview of foreign policy, but certainly, you know, more tariffs, more investment in domestic industries, you know, looking at trade and foreign policy through that lens. And in some ways, getting out of Afghanistan was also through that lens. It's like, why are we spending money here? Why are American kids dying here? Even though by that point, it wasn't really very many left in the country. you know, but I mean, I really do believe that Biden and the people around him sincerely do not want another major war that U.S. troops are on the ground in. I mean, you know, in some ways, what was always weird about the Ben Rhodes blob formulation, I think, is that the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan were pretty exceptional. Mm-hmm. That is, if you look at the let's say, you know, let's bracket off the Vietnam War because it's such an epochal thing. But at the end of the Vietnam War, you know, you've got kind of the world that Henry Kissinger left for us, the foreign policy landscape Henry Kissinger left for us, that's never really gone away, and that kind of defines blob logic. And really, over the, you know, 50-year period we're talking about, the U.S. is constantly intervening, constantly bombing countries, overthrowing governments, threatening to bomb countries, backing one side of a civil war, arming proxy states. There's tons of that. And the blob is always here for all that. But very, very rarely do you see 100,000 U.S. troops on the ground occupying a country indefinitely. Mm-hmm. That happened basically twice. And it happened in the wake of 9/11, this truly exceptional event that understandably, in some ways, drove the entire American elite insane for a few years. And it was under those, and not just the elite, it drove America insane, but the elite included, the people in Washington, New York, who kind of shaped these consensus, you know, were traumatized by it. And the public was ready to be called for something. And so we ended up occupying two large countries for a long time. But that's really not business as usual. And Joe Biden, who, if it had been up to him, we would have been out of Afghanistan more than a decade earlier, starting in 2009, even though he did back both the Afghan and Iraq wars initially. But, you know, he was the dissenter in the Obama administration on that. Mm-hmm. Joe Biden, who you know, his son, Beau, his late son, Beau, was a Marine who served in Iraq. And served with the current defense secretary, Lloyd Austin, in Iraq. He had a sensitivity to this, and I believe he still does. And so I don't think, for however conventional his foreign policy thinking is, I don't think Joe Biden wants to send a bunch of American troops anywhere in large numbers on the ground. However, that said, there's a lot more to aggressive blob foreign policy than putting a lot of American troops in harm's way. And in all other respects, when you look at, you know, so, I mean, their priorities were, you know, help the American middle class, get out of Afghanistan, end the forever war, meaning the post 9/11 war on terror, basically, or at least wind it down to something manageable. You know, what weren't and probably along with the entire blob consensus, pivot to containing a rising China, but not with an eye towards starting World War III with it. Quite the opposite. The idea is to discourage World War III by building strong relations with Japan and Vietnam and the Philippines, so that China is afraid to try anything, you know, over Taiwan. And that's not a major theme in the book, but most of Washington agrees on some version of that, and it's a matter of degree over how aggressive you get. But, you know, essentially two major events have collided with this vision, or arguably you could say three, the arguable one being just how badly the Afghan withdrawal went. You know, at the end of the day, they got it done and we're not invested in Afghanistan anymore. And that's for the best as far as American interests. But it obviously looked terrible, was terrible for Biden's approval and his reputation and the reputation of the people advising him. And they all kind of took it as a failure, even though, you know, it's done. They did get out. And that is a commitment severed. It's rare that you can so definitively say that something is done, but that's done. When it comes, but the two big events that they did not cause, but they also did not prevent, and that have consumed their foreign policy attention, are Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the October 7th attack, you know, which as a result mean that Biden's foreign policy is going to be remembered prominently for how they enabled this Israeli atrocity in Gaza that's ongoing, and for their response to Russia. Now, you've talked to me multiple times in the last 2 years about the war in Ukraine, mm-hmm. and you probably think I'm hawkish on it relative to you, relative to some people we know.
I think you're more hawkish than I am, but I mean, within degrees. I mean, continue.
I think that divisions on the left over Ukraine have actually been reduced in some ways over time, as everyone kind of grumbles their way to the same unsatisfying consensus, which is, yes, this is. Yes, there's a NATO back history that Americans are implicated in, which I never denied. But also, yes, Putin picked this war, and it's a disaster that he did, and he really is quite evil, and the Ukrainians have a right to defend themselves. And it's not totally unreasonable for the U.S. to back Ukraine in defending itself. But as the final caveat, and, you know, it's not going great. But I'll caveat further, you know, there was a failed Ukrainian counteroffensive last summer. But I'll caveat further, that doesn't mean I think we were wrong or are still wrong to support them. Because I think that left-wing critics of the U.S. policy here have always really downplayed just how bad it would have been if Russia had rolled over Ukraine and basically demonstrated that you can do that. But for yet another caveat, because I keep going back and forth here, U.S. policy in Gaza, which is to me straightforwardly evil and indefensible and wrong, has also had the knock-on effect of undermining our credibility in what we're trying to do in Ukraine. You know, we could have and I wrote about this actually for The Nation, but we could have a consistent policy here, which is invading and occupying your neighbor and bombing civilian densely populated cities is wrong, and the U.S. opposes it categorically. But instead, we've decided our policy should be it's good when Israel does it, but bad when Russia does it, which to the entire rest of the world looks hypocritical. And, you know, and of course, Zelensky, not that I really blame him, but, you know, has bought into this basic logic because we're his patron. And it just doesn't make Ukraine's cause look as sympathetic as I still think it is.
But what I can say
categorically as far as the Biden administration is, these are not the two situations they wanted to spend their presidency on. Neither one is doing great things for them politically. In the case of Ukraine, I think the policy certainly was popular. I'm sure it's not as popular as it used to be. The right has really allied with Putin, which in some ways I think highlights why it is still a righteous cause. You know, it certainly caused economic shockwaves, which were not good for the American middle class. I'm not saying that was necessarily their fault, but it does speak to, you know, the unexpected, how difficult it is to just sort of idealistically impose the kind of foreign policy you want, given the actual commitments the United States has in the world. And then as far as Israel, I mean, it's just a total disaster in every way. And it very well might cost Biden re-election.
Yeah, no. I mean, the only caveat I'll say on that is it's not, you know, well, there's two caveats. One is I don't think one can necessarily blame, you know, Biden for October 7th or for Putin invading Ukraine. But I think there's a lot of criticism of American foreign policy that led to both these disasters. And I think that this is something that goes beyond Biden, but as you know, a general unwillingness to do diplomacy, a general, you know, unwillingness to have been concerned about Russia, and how all the NATO expansion stuff looked. I mean, I think that, and really the intervention into Ukraine of creating a situation where Ukrainians were put in the position of having to decide between East and West rather than, you know, like their more natural position geographically and culturally and historically as a bridge between East and West. And you know, like with the Middle East as well, like, you know, like it's not like, you know, Biden caused October 7th, but I think the whole policy bipartisan foreign policy of like, you know, the Palestinians don't matter. We're going to the main goal is normalization with Saudi Arabia and the Arab autocracies with Israel. And really that Arab democracy doesn't matter. I mean, that is a kind of consensus foreign policy. I think that's naturally going to, you know, lead to situations where you have like, you know, horrific terrorism and mass uprisings. I mean, like that.
In a narrow sense, I agree with you. And in fact, I more or less argue that in the piece where I emphasize Victoria Nuland on Ukraine policy and Brett McGurk on Middle East policy as two figures who are seen as hawks in their respective theaters, who are, you know, who focus on particular theaters instead of being, you know, concerned with the sort of totality of Biden foreign policy as Sullivan or Blinken are, and who also have been in multiple administrations under both parties. So they both kind of point to the long history. So I agree with you and say in the piece that there is a multi-decade prehistory to both of these wars that, speaks that Ward certainly could have focused more on. However, I will draw one distinction between the two situations, which is, you know, I've criticized NATO expansion in the past, but I also think one can reasonably defend it in good faith. I mean, this is something on which I think intelligent people can reasonably disagree. You know, you look at what's happened to Ukraine and you can see it as, you know, a consequence of the arrogance of NATO expansion, and it probably is. But you can also see it as essentially, well, this is what Russia does to a country that's not in NATO. Like, from the point of view of Lithuanians, Latvians, Estonians, Poles, Romanians, you know, it makes perfect sense to me why they would be very grateful that they're in NATO right now, because Russia's not bombing them. And, you know, on some level, what the realist Mearsheimer argument, which I understand and see the case for, but on some level, it's basically an argument. Sorry to sound like a neocon here, but it's basically an argument to appease the local mafia, Don, right? I mean, it's basically the argument, don't give these countries what they in fact want. Because there's a thug with a gun to their head, you know, and we're moving in on their turf. I mean, it's this, what you just said about kind of natural spheres or bridge between East and West. I mean, no, I mean, it's basically that in plain English, what we're saying is Russia should be the boss of a certain region of the world. And we see how they enforce that, which is quite brutally. And I'm not saying from a perspective of foreign policy wisdom, overreach, you know, preventing overreach, preventing imperial arrogance. I'm not saying that that's not a valid consideration, but I do think we should be clear about what it is we're really saying there. All of which I would contrast with the Israel situation, where the actual bipartisan policy, and one which Donald Trump made considerably worse, and then Biden basically, locked in everything he had done, is let's oppress the Palestinians forever. It's let's let Israel run an apartheid state over the Palestinians forever. That is consensus in Washington, only challenged at the left fringes. And, it was bad under Bush, Clinton, Bush again, Obama. But we shouldn't gloss over, especially since, sad to say, this is the choice we face in November. We shouldn't gloss over just how over the top bad the Trump administration was.
Yeah.
And we also, sad to say, shouldn't gloss over just how bad Biden has been in terms of basically locking in Trump's achievement. And the key figure who represents continuity between these policies is Brett McGurk, who Akbar Shahid Ahmed of Huffington Post has done some terrific reporting on. Because what did Trump do? Trump surrounded himself with hard right-wing Zionist Israel hawks, like, you know, well beyond the Washington mainstream, including his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. These people, basically, their view is that the Palestinians get nothing, that the Palestinians have no rights, and we shouldn't even pretend they have rights. They decided they wanted to broker a quote-unquote Arab-Israeli peace deal. And what they meant by that was improving Israel's relationships with brutal Arab autocracies that don't care about Palestinians at all, like the United Arab Emirates, and ultimately Saudi Arabia. And the holy grail for Brett McGurk, who worked in the Trump and Biden administrations, is a normalization deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel. So the Saudi Arabia of MBS, the Saudi Arabia that, you know, saws dissidents apart and gets away with it. That's who he wants to work with. So all of which is to say that, you know, so what did they do? They did the Abraham Accords. They blew off the Palestinians. They never even tried to do a peace deal with the Palestinians in the way that the previous several administrations had made some effort to do. Even the George W. Bush administration mm-hmm. took that a lot more seriously than Trump did. They considerably worsened policy from, you know, where it had been over several decades. And then Biden, you know, they moved the embassy to Jerusalem, which was a huge symbolic victory for the Zionists. Trump is a hero in Israel. Netanyahu mm-hmm. loves Trump.
The Israeli public loves Trump.
The Israeli pub, there's like a settlement named after Trump. Yeah. And Biden comes in and it's all fait accompli. He doesn't go back on any of it. They keep pursuing the Abraham Accords. Oh, they also, totally unforced error for U.S. foreign policy, pulled us out of the Iran deal, which Obama, to his great credit, had really labored over in the face of fierce opposition. They just scrapped the whole thing. And the Biden administration barely tried to undo that. Mm-hmm. Some will say, well, you know, the Iranians didn't want to, which of course... Or the Iranians weren't going to play fair. But, like, why would they after what Trump did and knowing Trump could come back? So all of this is to say, and in the Ward book, too, there's this Middle East chapter about the war that happened in 2021 with Gaza, you know, which was all of those wars look small compared to the current one. But, you know, there have been, I don't know, five or so previous Israel-Gaza wars that basically involved 1,000, 2,000, however many Palestinians dying in Gaza. That happened in 2021, and Brett McGurk was caught flat-footed by that. And Ward is good on that, actually. And so, you know, did they cause October 7th? No, not directly. Not as directly as, for instance, Netanyahu did by enabling Hamas for years as his basic policy for managing Gaza and by leaving the border as poorly defended as he did. But, you know, I do kind of feel like something like this was going to happen sooner or later. And the Biden administration, I would love to hear one person say one good thing they did to make this less likely to happen prior to October 7th.
Yeah, I think we're in complete agreement about, like, you know, the disaster of Israel policy. The other point about Ukraine, first of all, it's not clear to me that Ukrainian public opinion is uniform or would be uniform if the U.S. had different policies. And I think the American reluctance to negotiate is a real tell here. And in the context of, you know, like Ukraine, you know, like a country that has a considerable Russian-speaking minority, it's a more complex thing than just an outside aggressor. I mean, I think there's been a real missed opportunities for negotiation. Going back decades, but even more recently, you know, like I think a lot of foreign policy people are coming out to the consensus that, like, you know, March 2022, you know, when they were negotiating in Turkey, that was a real moment, and that was lost. And I'm not sure that the United States was serving the best interest of Ukraine by, you know, encouraging fighting a war that has, you know, like in terms of the loss of life and the damage done to, you know, the infrastructure and natural environment of Ukraine has been devastating. You know, I just think, like, you know, the pattern of American reluctance to engage in diplomacy is a through line, and I think that that's something that Biden can be criticized on. Acknowledging all the sort of crimes of Putin and the
In the Ward book, it is clear they did try quite a bit of diplomacy to stop the war from happening, Putin was pretty determined. Zelensky also was basically caught off guard. They kept trying to convince him it was happening, and it seemed unthinkable to him. Everything changed when Putin actually did it. And I think indicative of how brazen and insane what Putin was doing was that most of the realist critics of U.S. foreign policy were completely shocked when he did it, because they thought he was a more, quote unquote, rational actor than that. And I think that speaks to some conceptual flaws in their analysis. Sometimes powerful people do crazy things that aren't predicted by game theory. And, ultimately, maybe this will work out for Putin and Russia's best interests. But I think it's hard to say unequivocally that it has. It's basically been a disaster all around.
Putin's obviously like a criminal, and but I mean, the whole question is the point that we got at, right at the invasion, where Putin was in power and the Russian national security state was aligned with him on this goal. I don't think that that was like preordained, and I think there were pathways to have avoided.
There almost certainly were pathways, but we should always remember just degrees of agency and moral hazard here. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Ukrainians wanted to fight, they want independence. They don't want to be a vassal of Russia. And under international law and prior agreements, that they're basically entitled to that. And insofar as the U.S. policy is basically to send them weapons and intelligence and money to make it possible for them to do that, when that's what they actually... I feel like a distinction has to be drawn here with Afghanistan, where the hawks in Washington were like, we can support this indefinitely. But it turned out, as soon as we said we were leaving, the Taliban easily overran the country because the government that we'd been propping up for 20 years was a corrupt, Potemkin state, basically, with no popular support. And the army wasn't willing to fight. And I feel like that's just a very meaningful difference. And then, of course, with Israel, it's like, in a sane world, we'd be backing the Palestinians in their independence struggle. So that one is just a totally different situation altogether. Yeah. But in the case of Ukraine, I mean, I do think that, and I've talked to people like your colleague Bhaskar Sankara about this. I mean, he's more hawkish on this than I would have thought.
He's more hawkish.
Because at a basic level, it's like people have a right to be independent, and if they're willing to take up arms to fight for their independence, I feel like that could be honored, and treating them as just pawns in a great power struggle seems, belittling in a way.
Well, okay. Except that I think it seems a little bit more complicated, just in the terms of you actually look at the actual willingness of Ukrainians to fight, and the increasing reliance of the government on conscription.
It's going very badly.
And so at some point, I mean, morally, if the Ukrainians could totally defeat Putin and kick them out of all that territory and recover that territory, that would be the best solution, and that is totally justified as a goal. The question is, can you actually achieve that goal? And if you can't achieve that goal, then at what point, do you open yourself up to negotiations, or do you pursue, as I think the United States, some cynical elements of the blob have been, this idea, if this is bleeding Russia, it's an easy and cheap war for us. To me, that seems like a much more harder thing to defend.
Well, the sad thing is, depending on how you look at it, but the faction that you're describing has kind of been losing. I mean, Victoria Nuland is leaving the administration, or she's leaving government, basically. And, she was in the minority. I mean, the reason why policy swung her way to the extent that it did, though never as far, of course, as she would have wanted it, is because Putin invaded. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever you can say about the long arc of U.S. foreign policy and her role in it, in this case, I don't think the Biden administration wanted this. And I do think it was kind of forced upon them. And I think you can, to a large extent, defend the balance they've struck in terms of what they have and haven't been willing to do for Ukraine. But there probably was an off-ramp. And the off-ramp was probably, I mean, this would have been a hard political sell. And I think people need to be honest, like domestically in Ukraine and in the United States, what a hard political sell it would have been, essentially to broker some kind of deal while they were doing well, instead of letting this counteroffensive happen. So now they're not doing well. You know, how exactly would Zelensky have, because any deal we're talking about is essentially conceding like 20% of the country's territory to the guy who invaded and bombed and, you know, raped people. And I mean, how do you sell that domestically?
Well, the thing is, I think if you actually, my sense is that from opinion polls in Ukraine, that moment, that sort of spring 2022 moment, will openness to negotiations was at a high point. It was a majority position among Ukrainians. And it has actually went lower now because the war has become, you know, much more horrific and has taken many more lives. So, I think that that's a moment that's worth revisiting. And I think more and more people are revisiting that, you know, like it's exactly when you're winning that you should like maybe try to like settle. But in any case, I don't think we're going to.
People should admit that had we gone, you know, had we just respected Putin's sphere of influence, what would have happened is, you know, they would have marched into Kyiv. Zelensky would be dead or in exile. Ukraine's government would have basically been remade as a puppet state for Russia. And a clear message would have been sent globally. You know, I hate to sound like a neocon, but like, you know, China would have taken a clear message there about what the US is willing to do. And I think it's a stretch to say the world would be more stable or secure if we had let that happen. I think the Biden administration can claim some credit for having actually stood up for Ukraine's fundamental right for sovereignty. And Ukraine is, let's say, 80% sovereign, and its government hasn't fallen. And I think that actually is an accomplishment. And, you know, it's Vladimir Putin's fault that Sweden and Finland joined NATO in a world where he was a quote unquote rational actor that never would have happened. So, you know.
That's a good note to end on, and it's a nice note because it is actually giving credit to Biden after a podcast where we've been critical of him on many points. I want to thank David once again for a really great and spirited conversation.
Always, it's a pleasure. I know we could have gone on for many hours more and have much more to say about Cold War liberalism, but that can be for another time.